My name is Ralph White, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Bob, for asking me to come out again. Thank the committee. Thanks, Tom. And thank all of you who've extended hospitality to me this weekend. This is the opportunity to come and share a state line is always a special one. I remember when this conference was a vision in Bob's mind, and to see it this morning and to see what it's grown to and to have had the opportunity to participate in it is always one of the highlights of my recovery. Sometimes I have mixed feelings. A couple of years ago, I was doing the third step. And right before I came downstairs from my hotel room, I got a call from home. And my wife was on the phone, and she was telling me some people were at the door tacking a notice of foreclosure on our house. And I was getting ready to come up and do the third step. And I was really entering the front end of what I like to refer to as like one of the valleys in my recovery. It was the third one. And I'll never forget what my fellowship, the fellowship I crave, did for me that Christmas. A lot of people were here at that time. Clancy, you remember. And I was in a real dark place. I was in a scared place. But I was in the best place to be in a scared, dark place. And there have been times in my recovery where I have literally been carried by the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was one of those times. Even though this is a weekend where we focus on the 12 steps, you know, my take, which is what it is, and what you'll always get from me, is a glimpse into the way that Ralph White lives inside of this design for living. My sponsor's here, and he always talks about you can't treat a spiritual condition with mechanical means. So I don't do the steps as a technical exercise. I don't do them. I'm not a step technician. I'm not here to argue with you about the way that you should apply a particular step in your life. I'm here as a person who stumbled into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, ill-equipped to deal with life. I stumbled into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, having had some successes in life and having lost everything that life had presented to me. One of the ones that came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous at 33 years of age, I had pretty much burned my life to the ground. One of six boys, all of us, you know, were in the life together. You know, three of my brothers are in recovery now. Four of us have once been in recovery. I had had the kind of life where, you know, I didn't have much growing up. In fact, you know, my mom raised six boys pretty much by herself most of my life. My father was an alcoholic, and he left pretty early in life. And my mom raised six boys by herself. I got a remarkable mom. First kid off my block to go to college. My brother Ryan followed me, and my other brother Reg was the next one, and we were the first three. And everybody knew the White boys. My last name is White. And everybody in my block knew the White boys, and my mother used to be very proud, and we used to make her proud and name in the paper and all that kind of stuff. Went off to school, big things expected. You know, I had dreams, goals, hopes, and ambitions. And one of the reasons why I love the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous, Gail did a wonderful job, as she always does, taking us through our history the other day. And one of the things I like the most about it is that some guys got together. One guy came out of the hospital almost on this date in 1934. And he came out for the last time. And he met another guy about 6 months later. And those two gentlemen set about proceeding to work with drunks. And a couple of years into their endeavors, they looked at each other and said, "How are we going to let Ralph White know when it's his time?" Decided to put me in the book. That amazes me. That amazes me. That this book that was published in 1939, and I didn't get on this earth until 1953, and I didn't make it to you guys till 1986, and they put me in this book. Remarkable. And in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, which is one of the reasons we're here this weekend to talk about this book, the basic text for our fellowship. And I believe, as much as I admire the way Bill wrote, some people talk about, oh, the way he wrote was stilted. I admire the way he wrote. And it seems to me, once some people got with me who had been through it before, you know, it talks to me. But in addition to Bill's intentions when he was putting down the information, as well as the other people who contributed, I think there were some unintended consequences that came. And we get to see them later on. And I don't know if it was the intent or I don't know if it was unintended, but one of the things that happens in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and it happens for every single step, three things take place in the book. First, I'll get the reasons why I need to apply that step to my life. Then I'll get precise instructions and directions on how to do it, how to apply this step inside Ralph's life. And then the third thing I get, and I like it at every one of the steps, we call them, you know, the results I get as if I practice these steps, call them the promises. And believe it or not, they don't just follow the ninth step. There are promises pretty much at the end of every step. Why I need to apply it, how to apply it, and the results I get if I apply this to my life. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And that's at the fourth step. You know, the first step, I had my experience, and the first step is a conclusion I draw based on my experience. I like these because other people set the groundwork, and so then all you have to do is pick up where they were. And I had my own first step experience. Carl laid it out there, and it's a conclusion I draw based on my experience. I don't have to come in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous to find the first step experience. What I do find in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is I get an understanding that that's what it was, because I'm twisted and I see things the way I see them. I didn't know that there was something bodily different about me. I suspected that there was, but I had it backwards. I thought that the reason I drank so much was, yeah, I'm bodily different. I got high capacity. I got talent, you know. The rest of you poo bus, you can't roll with the big dogs. And that's the way I saw it, high capacity. No, dude. The reason you do it so much is because, one, some Carl put it, when you start drinking, you get thirstier, you know. I don't know if I was born without a regulator, or I don't know if my regulator broke. I don't know which one it is, but I don't have a turnoff valve. Once I get started, I keep going, you know. And then there's something else that happens. When I'm not drinking, I can't stop thinking about it. Or I start again. I start the process again, even when I said I'm not going to. And if that be the case, I love that two-question test that's in We Agnostics. If when I start, I can't control the amount, or if when I don't want to again, I start again anyway, then you're probably alcoholic. And that's a conclusion I draw based on my experience. Step one is the problem. Step two is the solution. And those are conclusions I draw based on my experience. You know, and if that be the case, I may be suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience will conquer. That's what we're here for. Whole deal. Looking for the spiritual experience. I'm the kind of guy, I'm a skeptic and I'm a cynic, and I look at my life, why only a spiritual experience got to conquer it? You know, I like when it talks in that second step, because it says, you know, to be doomed to die an alcoholic death or to live life on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives. Alcoholic death, slow death, walking the streets at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, just won't lay down death. People looking at you, talking about you, kids are disgusted by you, not showing up with the Christmas, but none of that slow, torturous death that so many of us know. Ugly death, degrading death, you know, weak, pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization death, that death, slow death, not just quick, lay down, no, slow. So to be doomed to that, or to live life. Why ain't there always easy alternatives? Because they stuck that other piece in there, or to live life on a spiritual basis, or not always eat. Why not? Why wouldn't they be easy alternatives? Gas chamber electric chair. Oh, shit. No. Cod liver oil, castor oil. Ooh, you know. And I find that when something's not an easy alternative, it's one of two reasons. One, because the alternatives look exactly alike. Or two, because the alternatives look equally unappealing. And that doomed to die an alcoholic death or live life on a spiritual basis sound the same to a guy like me. Life on a spiritual, that's slow death too. No fun, no sex, no doing what you like to do, no sex the way you like it at any rate, no this, no, you know. Not always easy alternatives. So a guy like me, entering a fellowship that you have to present to me, entering into the solution for what it is that ails me, it seems difficult. It seems difficult, but don't trip. You know, the book don't say it like don't trip. It'll say something like don't be disconcerted or some word. But don't trip. Don't trip. Almost half of us felt like you felt. You know, had problems with this God idea. We put a name on it. We call it agnostic. You know, you might think you believe, but you act like you don't. You know, you might think there's a God, but you think he worked for Charlie. He ain't going to work for you. You know, you got all these things going on. So then it gives me some instructions on how to do that. And the whole deal is about this idea of the spiritual experience. Because I suffer from an illness and only a spiritual experience. Like how I know only, what makes me believe only, because I tried a financial experience, didn't do it. I tried a physical regimen experience, didn't do it. I tried the self-knowledge experience, didn't do it. The intellectual experience didn't do it. The emotional experience didn't do it. The love experience didn't do it. The romance experience didn't do it. The parent experience didn't do it. You know, none of them. None of the other experiences did it. I'm flat out of answers. I'm back against the wall. I'm at step two in a state of desperation. Okay. All right. I get okay. Maybe it is only the spiritual experience. Then why are you so resistant to it? Because you don't know what it looked like. And you think you do. And you think you do. So that whole portal that we open up in that second step, and the only reason that I jump through, you know, when opportunity meets desperation, a window of grace opens up. And on October 11th, 1986, desperation met opportunity. My brother was in the Harbor Light Center already, and I was tore up and tired again. And I jumped through the window of grace. Jumped through the window of grace. It's a small window. It opens up for us at various times. Everybody sitting in this room had jumped through at one point. Came through. And flat out of ideas. You know, I did that negative second step before I did the second step. I had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as I had been leading it. And it wasn't nothing else left for me. I hope you're right. I hope you're right. Suffering from an illness is only a spiritual experience to conquer. So then I have to do something. If okay, you're telling me I need a power bigger than me. I already have come to believe in a power bigger than me. I call it a king alcohol. I needed a power bigger than it. I need a power bigger than it. So I said, okay, I'm willing to believe because I don't have no other option. I'm tired and I don't want to face the life again. You know, and we don't have many new people, but I remember being new and they used to talk about the yets. If it hasn't happened to you, put a yet on it. If it hasn't happened to you, put a yet on it. And the speaker this morning, what I'm scared of the agains. Forget later for the yets. I'm scared of the agains. I just don't want to live that life I was leading before. So I'm up here and I'm doing the deal. I'm open to this spiritual experience. I'm open to the medicine because I'm dying. You're telling me this is the prescription, only a spiritual experience to conquer the illness that you suffer from. I'm open to it because I'm dying. Only reason, not out of virtue, not because I'm a good guy, out of desperation. Okay, now what? Okay, if you're gonna tell you, if you believe that the medicine will work for you, you better decide to take it. All right. So I get on my knees with a group of people, you know, and I so enjoy Carla and I so enjoy Marilyn. And I love the way Carla kicked this thing off because she gave us everything in her talk, you know. And so I got down on my knees with some people and made a decision that I'm going to take the medicine, that I want this spiritual experience, that I need this spiritual experience. Forget wanting. I need this spiritual experience that'll conquer what it is that I'm suffering from. If it's the only thing that's out there, you know how people with this cancer patients and they just run out of ideas and nothing else to treat them. They'll go to Tijuana. They'll travel to Ecuador. They'll go anywhere. It's the only thing out there. It's the only thing out there for a guy like me. So I get on my knees and I say, okay, God, this God that I don't know too much about, know nothing, really don't have that much to do with, do something with me. Powerful prayer to me. A third step prayer, most of us have said it that's in this room right now. It is so powerful for me. Every time I think about it, first time I did it, I was a little less than a year sober and I was with a group of people. And I said, God, I offer myself to you. And that just amazes me when I think about it. God, I offer myself to you. Katie, with my less than a year and the condition I was in and tore up as I was and I wasn't a vision for you, if I'd have said, Katie, I offer myself to you, you'd have been like, keep it moving, dude. I really ain't, you know. But I say, God, I offer myself to you, and he took me. And he don't matter the condition, no matter where you come from, no matter your station in life, you know, in churches and in other places I had gone before, there were some preconditions to enter the door. You got to believe a certain way. You got to accept some things. You got to admit that you accept these things. And you got to say, I'm down with the program and I'm going to stop doing it. I'm coming right now. Well, for folk like us, if we got to come right to get right, we might, this room would be empty. Come just as you are. I did the third step just in the condition I was in. That just blows me away, this power. And that was one of the first, that was one of my first changes in you know, the Bazanzas were up here talking and both Bob and Peter both used the word. I'm like, oh, okay, I like, you know, paradigm. You know, they were talking about paradigm shifts. And I'm like, okay. I like throwing them out sometimes too. You know, so my first change in view. You know, and I was like, wow, the idea that this piece of man could come as he was and present. So a lot of us do that third step. And then you'll find yourself, maybe you've heard yourself say it before. I turn it over and I take it back. I turn it over and I take it back. I keep turning it over and I keep taking it back. What's up with that? I like the reading they did before I came up this morning. Although that step was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in me that's blocking me. Grace flows, I block. Grace flows, I block. God is God all by himself and he don't need my permission, but he does need my cooperation to work in my life. God is doing what it is he do all the time. And all he do is grace flows, but the receptor, the receiver is blocked. And so this whole idea of spiritual experience is all about clear channel. Clear channel. And we start clearing the channel at the fourth step because I'm blocked by a bunch of stuff. You know, and we agnostic, it talks about some of the things that block me. Worship other things. I like chasing money, chasing women, chasing fame, chasing popularity, chasing, you know, pomp, worship of other things, calamity, looking at the things that have happened in my life. Can't be no God there. Can't be nothing happening good for me. So I'm blocked by old ideas. So this idea, personal inventory, this idea of self-examination, an unexamined life is a life that's not worth living anyway. You know, that's a spiritual axiom. This whole deal is about clear channel. And so this thing we do when we get to that fourth step, take a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. In the book, Bill, you know, analogizes that to a commercial inventory. And he calls it a fact-finding and a fact-facing process. Fact-finding, fact-facing. You know, they got big sales going on, you know, the Black Friday sales that took place after Thanksgiving. And right before they do that, I'm sure all the stores go through and they clear the shelves. You know, they go through and they take a look around and you know, they look and they say, okay, got a big electronics store. Christmas is coming in 2011. Let's take a look at what we got back here so we can see we got a whole bunch of new stuff we got to put in here, but we got to make room. And so you go through the store and you go through the back and you go through the aisles, and lo and behold, what are these turntables doing still in here? We ain't sold a turntable in I don't know how many years. Well, get this out of here. What are these VCRs doing? And we ain't doing plus a Betamax is sitting up in there. Get rid of it. What is that about, you know? And so a real 8-tracks up in here. When is the last time somebody looked at this warehouse anyway? You got 8-tracks and cassette players and all that. So I'm looking at that, and even though they're brand new, nobody's buying. Can't lie to myself about values. So the owner of the store says, pack it all up. We're going to take it out of here. And the reason we're taking it out of here is because we're making way for some brand new stuff. Well, Ralph White gets to you guys at 33 years old, and he's got in the stock that is his stock and trade, his thinking, and his beliefs, and his values, my stock in trade. I had to go back and do the same thing. I had to inventory that the same way, and I couldn't lie to myself about values. You might have a closet that you ain't looked at in a long time, and yeah, women, I know you like all that stuff that's in there, but when you get to shoes, when you get to 200 pairs and you ain't gonna wear none of them, it's time to get rid of some of that stuff. Ralph, go up in there, you got these Fred Astaire pants. What? You ain't your mother. You know, platform shoes. So you clean that stuff up. But it's new. But they knew, they haven't been worn. You ain't going to wear them either. They out of style. Nobody's buying. And you don't look good in them. You look crazy. You know, and it's the same thing. Same thing with my thinking. Yeah, when you hurt my feelings, Gaten, and I, you know, while it's debatable if pouting and throwing a tantrum has ever been involved, it fits a 3-year-old way better than a 58-year-old. That ain't cute, Ralph. And that's what I do. Hurt my feelings. I pout. I withdraw. I punish you by not talking to you. I lay anybody in here in relationship. That's a cold place to be. You know, you're going to lay in the bed and you're going to lay on this side, and I'm going to punish you. You know, the passive punishment. I'm just not going to talk to you. But it's a cold thing when the person being punished don't know their own punishment. You know, and she on the phone with her sponsees laughing. And you ain't supposed to be laughing. You on punishment. You are on time out. What are you doing? You know. Oh, I'm glad I'm not the only one. That's what I do. So this idea of inventory. And so it talks about an inventory. It says, and there are some things, and I'm going to talk about inventory for a minute. I'm not only going to talk about it in an overview way. I'm going to talk about it in somewhat in a specific way. And I'll talk about the way I talk about inventory and the way that I do inventory, not the way to do inventory. Folks get hung up on, you know, and I'll be in the line sometime and I'll talk about some stuff, and somebody about person number 32 will come up and say, I like what you said. Oh, you heard that one too, huh? You heard that one too, huh? But you forgot to leave out there, but you don't do this. Hey. This is just the way I do it. I can't say what I don't do just because you do it. I'll share what I do, right? So don't trip. This is, you just get Ralph because this is who you got this morning, okay? But this idea of inventory. Effort to face and be rid of. Crucial fact about inventory. If my life run on my will is successful, don't do it. Don't write. Sponsors, don't be fooling with people trying to browbeat them and beat them up. How come you ain't right? If your life run on your will is successful, have at it. But for those of us who are tired of running in the walls in your life, for those of us whose life has proven to be a train wreck waiting to happen or having happened, for those of us who are convinced that me at the wheel is not a good idea based on my own experience, this book has something to offer. It's something freeing about getting a new employer. It's something freeing You know, in the third step promises, it talks about having a new employer. You know, we are his, you know, children. He's the father. You know, he's the principal. We're his agents. And it makes a lot of analogies about the relationship between me and this power that I don't know yet. That's the cool thing about access to power. You ain't got to know the power to access the power. You don't have to know the power in a full-fledged way. It's people in here, Clancy, been doing this over 50 years, been on a path, and I'll listen to him share, and I'll be like, yeah, that's easy for you. If I could believe like you, but you ain't got to believe like me. Check this out. This is the best way I can think about relationship with this power, because I'm not interested in knowledge of the power. If you came here this weekend because you want to get a whole lot of knowledge and information, that's cool. You'll leave with some, but what the process is really about is access to and relationship with. I need relationship with the power. I need to have a relationship for myself that's mine, that's my own. Knowledge ain't going to work for me. I'm not interested in a knowledge experience. I need a relationship with this power. And the thing about it, and the thing I like the most about having access early without having a well-defined sense of what the power is, without having a full-fledged concept of what God is for me, because mine continues to grow. The power will improve your understanding of the power. Don't worry about it. The power will improve your understanding of the power. Don't trip off that. Don't worry about where you're going to be later on. Just get on the path. Just decide I'm going to turn my life over to something bigger than me that's better able. Here's the best analogy. How many parents we got in here? We got a lot of parents, right? Remember, and every single one of you, if you're parents, you've had a baby. And the thing about a baby, I've looked at several pictures since I've been here of grandparents showing me their babies. And their grandkids. The thing about a baby, check this out, a baby, 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 you the parent, right? Baby is 4 days old, 5 days old. Baby don't know you daddy, you mama. They don't have a concept of daddy, mama yet. They just have a concept that I'm in this earth. I'm out the womb. I'm now in sunlight, daylight. I don't know what they're thinking. So, Ralph, don't get carried away. I can't tell you what they're thinking. But the baby is here, right? And what happens? Without the baby having to know I'm mama or I'm daddy, guess what? Mama and daddy is nurturing, protecting, caring for that baby in a way that they'll never do it again. They are just taking care of the baby. The baby ain't got to know this is mama. The baby ain't got to acknowledge me as daddy. The baby ain't got to be able to say nothing yet. I'm waiting for the day when the baby going to say, dad, dad. I'm hoping he's before he say, mom, you know. But I'm waiting. I'm waiting for the day. But the baby don't know. The baby is getting the best care the baby has ever received. There's no care like an infant get when an infant is an infant, right? Baby, baby. Don't have a concept of mama. Don't have a concept of daddy. Don't have a concept of this power that's taking care of them. Don't have a concept of this power that's directing their life and taking care of their life. But the baby has access to that power just like they are. And I look at that. I'm a baby on the spiritual path. And I'm just like, and God is just, okay, you my boy. You my boy. Don't worry about if I can call him by name yet. Don't worry about it. I just want to. I know I need protection. I know I need care. I know I need direction. I know my life is off the rails. I know I'm entering into a new life. Book talks about you will be reborn. Roots, grass, new soil. So I'm on this path, just like the baby. So if you knew and if you're struggling, get rid of the old idea. That's the best place. Because guess what? When you're full of self-will and when you're full of ego and you're full of that stuff getting rebuilt, you spend the rest of your time walking away from the power anyway. Baby. So I'm coming out of this third step and I'm in this fourth step. So being convinced that my life run on my will can hardly be a success. First requirement to do this deal. I'm not going to even fool with it if not. So then we say, being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what it defeated us. Another, you know, there are some concessions that are required of me in this step. And I have to concede that I've been defeated. If you still last gasping, well, why I got to be defeated? You ain't. Keep doing what you're doing then. You ain't. Keep doing what you're doing. You know, it's one thing in this process that every person in here had to bring to the table. Nobody else can bring it for you. Sponsor couldn't. Bill Wilson couldn't. Dr. Bob, if you were there, they couldn't. None of your friends could. Your mama can't. Your kids can't. Nobody else can. It's one ingredient. It's one element I have to bring to the party. Willingness. Willingness. And I don't think willingness up. Now, I don't wish it up. In my experience, it's one thing to give me willingness. Well whooped ass. My experience. And so mine was whooped enough and I was tenderized enough that October 1986 that I came to you guys fertile ground. Fertile. So being convinced of my life, running my will. Self-manifested in various ways with what has defeated us. We consider the common manifestations of self, the way Ralph shows up to life, the way Ralph presents, the way that you will see the things in me that have caused most of my problems. And in the book, it talks about we're going to look at three specific areas, big areas. And if I look at these areas, if I inventory these areas, I will be well on my way to clearing the channel for that grace to flow through. Because I've connected to a power. Because make no mistake about it, I'm not here today because I'm a perfect 12-stepper. I'm not here today because of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous keeping me sober. I'm not here today because of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous keeping me sober. I'm here today and I'm real clear that there's one thing that keeps me sober and one thing only. God's grace. God's grace. I have 12 steps that will allow me clear channel to keep grace flowing. Keep having the access to the grace. That's it. That's God's grace. Some folk think if I practice these steps perfectly, well, then that's a self-determined goal. That's me. If I just write the best inventory, that's me. If I sponsor the most people, that's still me. All these things are all required, but I need to know what they require for, because this process of recovery, just like everything in the book, is two sides to it. And a guy like me can use the process to subvert exactly what the process is designed to do. What the process is designed to do is reduce my ego. Grow God, shrink Ralph. Process is designed to reduce my ego. Grow God, shrink Ralph. But Ralph can use the process to grow my ego. Grow Ralph, shrink God. I know everything. I know this. How are you going to try to tell me? I do workshops. I speak all over. I'm up at State Line. What? You know. But, of course, I wouldn't wear it like that. I wear it with the proper cloak of humility. You know, yeah. Because you need to know who I am. I'm a master manipulator. I'm that guy. I know how to wear humility, think superiority. So I'm real careful about what it is that I do. And in a real way, because you don't go home with me. I'm the one that walk the streets. I don't want to walk the streets at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning no more. I don't want to have to live in my mama's house and lay on her floor again. I don't want to not be in my daughter's lives again. I don't want to walk the aimless walk again. I've tasted it and I like it. So this deal that we do is really important for me. No, I don't have to talk about it. It's important for me. So this ego-reducing exercise, I take it for what it is. So these deals, so this fourth step, common manifestations of self. First one we talk about is resentment. Resentments. Book says that's the number one offender. Has the power to actually kill. Anybody believe that resentments had a power to kill? I'd like to see the hands that go up. Sometimes I say that I do. But if I really believe that, sometimes I think I must put on a vest of a suicide bomber. Because sometimes I sure get them and want to nurse them. Claim I know that they killed Charlie. I'm in one. I was in one. Because don't some people need a good cussing out every now and then? You got to check them every now and then. Okay? You can't let them go too far. If you don't stop them right here, where are they going to be next week? Right? If you don't take care of yourself, who will? We laugh and we talk. Go inside your experience. Most of the things that give me problems because there's a germ of truth in it. Sometimes there seems to be a germ of truth in resentments working. The reason why resentments are so problematic is because sometimes they seem to work. Sometimes they seem to work. Somebody's on your back, boss on your back at work. I remember not too long ago having an experience like that. On your back at work, had a coworker who was kind of, we call him, you know, oh, he crazy. You know how that person, oh, yeah, they crazy, you know. And then the person that, oh, yeah, they crazy, go off in a way that they go off because something unjust or unfair happens. And it seems as if, wow, don't nobody mess with them no more. And it seems like resentments are work. You might be the crazy person. You might be the one that does that every now and then. And sometimes in relationships, you with your old lady, she with you, and then you enter into that region where seem like the only time they get off you is when you really come crazy. And so I say, sometimes resentments seem to work. They seem to give me respect. They seem to protect me. Somebody mess with your kids. Somebody do something to you. Somebody, you know, really does harm to somebody. And I feel like if I let go of that anger, I'm opening myself up for that to happen again. If I don't take care of me, who will? Logical, reasonable, and I don't know who was talking about Bob. Bob was talking about the computer chips and the programs that run unknown to us. You know, there's the daddy program that runs unknown to me. You do something to my daughter, pew, that chip goes in. A daddy is supposed to stand up. A daddy's supposed to go to jail if he have to. A daddy is supposed to hurt. You don't mess with mine. Ping, it goes in. The man chip goes in. Oh, Chris tried to punk you like that. You can't let him. Not in front of everybody. No. I'm the kind of guy that would take an ass whooping rather than let you know how scared I was about getting one. Because I can't let you see I'm scared. So now I'm engaged. Now it's going to happen. But I'd rather do, you know, but that idea, the manship goes in and the program boots up. And you can't let another guy he can't talk to you like that. Nuh-uh. You know, penitentiary is full of guys who prove they can't be talked to like that, by the way. Their program ran and they acted on it. So this idea of resentments, you know, that runs deep. So what I like the most about the process is I don't talk about steps as independent homework assignments. This 12-step process we have is an integrated series of actions that become a lifestyle for me. And they are designed for, and it's the way I live. And one thing stands on the other, or else I can't live it. I can't live it. Because you're absolutely right. I cannot abandon my old. Remember at the beginning, and the reason we say you have to abandon old ideas absolutely. You know, in my home group, they used to say you can't live the streets in the rooms. You know, because you can't come in here with the street, with the whole thing. Because in the streets, you don't tell on yourself. You don't tell your business. You never let them see you sweat. You definitely don't let nobody get away with nothing. You got to check him right there or it's going for. You got to let go of all that. Dudes, you got to let go of all that. And then one of the things I had to embrace it, and I still have to embrace it. It's the thing that underlies most of the other activities that we do in the program. And that one is humility. That one is humility. And I have to begin to see humility as strength. Otherwise, I can't do none of the rest of it. I can't do any of the rest of it. I can't do any of the rest of it. Well, two things. One is desperation. That one still got to hold me. The one that says, Ralph, if you don't take the medicine, this is what's going to happen. That one is huge. And then the humility. The humility of living with that. So that whole resentment idea. So now I get convinced that that's a big one. That's a big, 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 big deal, because I think they work for me and I think that they have value for me. I've even heard people say, I stayed sober a year and a half off of resentment. I'm the kind of guy that believes just because you say something doesn't mean it's true, even though it's about your life. That's like somebody saying I beat cancer off of resentment, you know. Okay, the doctor told me I wouldn't live, so I'm just going to have a resentment and live. No. In the meantime, when the doctor told me that, I kept going to chemo, I kept taking the medicine, I kept changing my diet, and I claim it was the resentment that did it. So people say I stayed sober a year and a half off of resentment. I was going to meetings, I was doing steps, I was taking actions, and because Chris at one time in my early recovery said to me, you ain't gonna make it, or I think that's what he said, he probably didn't even say it. So when people say that kind of stuff to me, I'll be like, yeah, okay, because resentment have never worked for Ralph White. Have never worked. Now, well, Ralph, what about the guy who says to Michael Jordan, you're not going to make the team? And he says, that resentment carried me further. Well, I would say that motivation carried me as opposed to that resentment, but we just splitting hairs now. So the kind of resentments we're talking about, what's a resentment anyway? To refill, somebody always says when I say, what's a resentment anyway? To refill something, to refill it. Wow, I had a sexual experience. I'm thinking about it now. I'm refilling it. I ain't mad. No, to refill or to refill hurt, to refill an injury, to refill an injustice. So anger is a human instinct. Human instinct. You know, we sitting here talking right now. All of a sudden, you know, Michael takes off. Hey, that's my boy. That makes me piss off. I'm not in a meeting. You get mad. Go away. You know, anger is a human instinct. It drives you, gives you adrenaline. It does some stuff, you know. But it's resentment that's the killer. The resentment is what I stay away from. And so the resentment is the refill, the hurt, an injury, a wound. And the thing about resentment is either real or imagined, they have the same power. Same power. Walk in the room, this table is sitting here and they all laughing. I walk in the room, they stop laughing. I look at Charlie and I'll be like, oh, he's talking about me. They stop talking, they look at me. I know they're talking about me. And then I go and I sit down, and when I leave the meeting, I think to myself, plus when Charlie looked at me, he kind of smirked at me, you know. And what was Bob doing in that group? Bob's supposed to be my boy. What he doing hanging with Charlie like that anyway, you know. Next thing you know, that whole table I'm mad at. Then, and you know they all fake at that meeting anyway, you know. Ain't going to that meeting no more. Next thing you know, they all faking Alcoholics Anonymous. Next thing you know, I'm not going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Next thing you know, I'm walking the streets at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. Came home one day, 12 days sober, 12 years sober. Wife at the time, 12 years sober. glass of wine on the counter. Who came over today? Nobody. Oh, quit playing. Who came over? Whose wine is that? Mine? Really? Really? Had gone through the phenomena, well-known stages of the spree in Alcoholics Anonymous. Come in. Can't nobody do nothing wrong. Stick around long enough. See the humanness in all of our members, because that's what we are. This is not the Glee Club. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. You know. Stick around long enough. You see the humanness not in all the not only in all the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, but you see it in your mate. And you start seeing it in your home group. And you start seeing it everywhere. And you get disillusioned. And you start throwing out the darts like them people are all fake up in there anyway. Including you. You know, and you start, next thing you know, you start backing away and you're backing out. I'm talking about things I know. And my wife drank for 4 years. Started just like that. Started just like that. So what do we do with these resentments anyway? We set them on paper. Set them on paper. I'm an old style guy. There are computer people now, and I don't have a problem with that. Set them down any way you got to set them down. Get on, go on and do it. And the thing about that, I think there's a power in pen to paper for me. For me, there's a power that starts flowing when I do that. So we set them on paper. Write them down. People, places, and institutions with whom we're angry. Then I ask myself, why am I mad? Second column of this resentment inventory. Resentment inventory is laid out in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I like the way it's laid out, and that's the way I write my resentment inventory. If you look on the page in the book where you see it, you'll see three columns, but on the two pages later, they'll talk about the fourth column, and the three columns talk about who am I mad at. Then it talks about why am I mad. That's the finger-pointing column. That's the column most of us live in. That's pretty easy. What am I mad about? The cause. You know, mad at my daddy. Why are you mad at your dad? He's an alcoholic. He left us. He was weak. You know, each one of those are their own resentment. I number my resentments and I write them separately and I do them really short. You know, really short. Don't write an essay when you're doing resentment inventory. You know, and don't combine resentments. The reason why I'm succinct with it is because I can then see the truth about it. You know, the cause. I mean, the resentment. I'm resentful at Michael, the cause. I loaned him some money, and he promised to pay me back, and I done seen him at 3 or 4 meetings since then, and now he's dodging me, and he keep coming up with excuses, owes me money. Owes me money. No, all that. You know. He lied to me, and he never tell me the truth. Same resentment. Lies. Lied to me. You know, don't double dip. There's no need to. And, you know, and be succinct with them. You know, strip away the verbiage. You can say that when you're doing your fifth step. You know, lie to me. You know, then I go to the third column. What part of me was affected? That comes out of the book, too. Was it my self-esteem? I use some definitions that are my definitions, not Webster's. But they're mine, and I use them. And if anybody likes to, they work for me and some people that I do this process with. Was it my self-esteem, the way that I look at myself? Was it my pride, the way I think other people see me? Was it my ambition, what I think I need to be, what I think I want to be okay? Was it my security, what I think I need to be okay? My personal relationships, any relationship where sex is not involved. Sexual relationships, any relationship where sex is involved, real, potential, imaginary. You know, was it my pocketbook? My pocketbook, my money, or my property? You know, and I look at those seven areas of self. And in each one of the resentments I have on my resentment inventory, I ask myself, was that affected? You know, and I go back to like my daddy. You know, my daddy, he left us. Wow, what part of me was affected? My self-esteem? If you loved me, you would not leave me. If I was worth loving, you know, you wouldn't have left me. My self-esteem, the way that I see myself, I must not be worth loving. You know, my pride, what I think other people think of me. He didn't think much of me or he wouldn't have left me. And I believe other people look down on me and my brothers, too, because we ain't got a daddy. My personal relationships, it affected my relationship with that man. It affected my relationships in school. I would lie about what it was like at the house, and I would feel so embarrassed that father-son banquets when my uncle would have to show up or nobody would show up. Shun going to those kind of events affected my personal relationships. My ambition, what I wanted to be okay. I wanted a Dr. Huxtable father. I wanted a father like that. I wanted a father, yes, son, and you know, he'd take me to places I'd be proud of him. That wasn't my daddy, you know. My security, what I needed to be okay. I needed a father's love. I needed a father's protection. I needed a father's guidance in my life. I needed a man to show me things that only a man could show me. Sexual relationships. Wow, Ralph, how were your sexual relationships hurt by your father leaving when you were 8 or 9 years old? And that's when you start seeing the beauty of doing a resentment inventory. Because the purpose of inventory is not to write down a bunch of stuff you already know about yourself. The purpose of inventory is for me to see the things I don't know about myself. What drives me? What motivates me? What's my belief system anyway? What's my value system? You know, and I started looking at that, and I've never known what it is to be a man, and I've always been scared that you know that I don't know. The rest of the guys always had a handle on the manhood thing I didn't have. You had a secret that you knew that I did not know, and I was scared that you would know that I didn't know. You know, I always have been scared of girls, and I bought my way into relationships, and I've always felt like if you really know me, you won't like me. My father was a weak and ineffectual man, and I did not realize how much of that I took in the relationships. If you really know me, you won't like me. I present well. You know, I think it was Carl that talked about it. I can't remember. Or maybe Bob's panel. But I interview well. I interview well, girls. When you meet my representative, then we do okay. But eventually you gonna know Ralph. And see, relationships are about representatives meeting most of the time anyway. When we talk about the sex of the day, you meet my representative. You're not meeting the guy. And I always feel like when you know the guy, you ain't gonna like me. Sex relationships. Pocketbook, obviously. My mama was raising 6 boys by herself. Now, even though my old man wasn't bringing in money, theoretically, he should have been contributing to the pots of my pocketbook. So each one of those 7 areas of self was affected. Each one of those 7 areas of self in that one resentment. And that's just the way I do it. Then we get to that part in the book, and it's a couple of things later. It says, when we read, you know, we've written this list and we've written that much so far. And it talks about one of the things that's readily apparent at this point is that the world and its people really dominated me. And that's me. That is me to a T. I'm dominated by what I think you think about me. And I'll do whatever it takes to change of shape and mold what it is, your opinion about Ralph. Dominated by that, you know. And it says, let's look at it from a new angle. Let's look at it from a new angle. And it's 2 things to look at when I go to that 4th column in my resentment inventory. One of them is this, and is the first thing I'm going to ask myself, where have I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or afraid? I'm going to go back to the other paragraph in a moment. But with my father, I want to talk about this one. Where have I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or afraid? Questions I ask myself in the 4th column. Selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or afraid? Selfish. Concerned with only my needs, wants, and views. You know, I was selfish because I ain't never thought about my old man and that resentment. I only thought about me. I didn't think about what it was like to be a janitor with about a 5th grade education, with 6 boys you're supposed to be raising now. I didn't think about what kind of fear was he under. I'm a father myself, college educated, just got 2, and I get scared about being a daddy. I get scared at the responsibility. I get scared at what it takes. I get scared, and I flounder, and I make mistakes, and I'm not good at it. And I do what it is that we do, you know. And I walked in his footsteps, but I'm selfish. I only think about me, how that impacted me. Dishonest. My father left us as a resentment. I'm dishonest. My father didn't leave. My mama put him out, and I knew it. I knew it. But a resentment doesn't care about the truth. A resentment cares about what it is, and it fuels and feeds itself. So I walked around years saying my old man left, knew good and well my mama put him out. He probably was as devastated as, you know, he was more devastated than me. I had somewhere to live. You know, you got to go. You know, I'm like, wow, light bulb. And I had this resentment. And the other part of the dishonesty was when my mom put him out, me and my brothers damn near party. We said, yeah, he looked good going. Because I wasn't proud, you know, looking back, and I'm not proud of how that made me as a son. But I didn't actively dislike my father. My father didn't abuse us, but he was very seldom around. But I didn't like the man. I barely knew the man. And I'm like, wow. So I got this dishonesty thing working. Left us. Like, I was so upset that he left because he couldn't do the thing. And, you know, and one of those resentments I had, you know, that because my ambition was hurt, he wasn't the husband because he seemed weak. My father couldn't have been Dr. Huxtable anyway. Sometimes the dishonesty is wanting something in a person that they're not capable of. I might as well have wanted my father to be 6'10". My father was 5'5". And I resent him for not being 6'10". He's not capable of that. My father wasn't capable of being Dr. Huxtable. My father had a fifth grade education and was a janitor. Wow. So my selfishness is I expect and want things and my dishonesty from you that you're not even capable of. It's not even the capacity. That's something you can't be. And I blame you and hold you responsible for it. Big one for me, always is, all my resentments. They say we bracketed the word fear alongside, and then it says we ask, where were we selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and afraid? So that fear thing is big because it says it two places. Father left us, scared of being looked down on, scared of being talked about, scared of being humiliated, scared of not being enough, scared of not having enough. Scared of you talking about us. Fear, 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 fear. And that's just one of them. I've been thinking, you know, because people say, yeah, okay. You know, resentment inventory. And so you write. And that's how I write them. And I write, how many people should you write about? I go back and I look at big groups, especially if you've never written inventory before. I do big groupings. I do family. And then I think about it. And if you've known me, if I've known you most of my life, there are not very many people I've had a close relationship with that I haven't copped some resentments about. You know, I don't edit and I don't censor and I don't think about it. If a name comes up, I put it on the list. I don't start thinking, well, I'm not mad at them right now. No, that ain't the way it goes. You know, that's not the way it goes. You know, I wrote about my grandmother and I wasn't mad about it. My grandmother died and I wrote about her and I wasn't proud about it. You know, and writing resentment inventory has nothing to do with being proud about who it is. It's just a stand up, man up and acknowledge who it is that you are. And yeah, you're capable of that. I'm capable of petty. I'm capable of illogical. That's me. You know, and so I write about them. Family, friends, classmates. If you've been in the military, you know, fellowship, church, you know, big groups of people. And I go back and I go through my life and I write about them. And since this is not going to be my only pass through, the only thing that counts is thoroughness and honesty. And it's as thorough as I can be at the time. Don't trip off that. Don't be beating people up. You can be more thorough, handing it back like it's homework. Do better. I don't even trip off that. You know, it ain't going to be my only inventory. It hasn't been my only inventory. You know, and I'm a person that I like to see now. It's there, whether I look at it or not. And it's a springboard for me. And it's a springboard for me to go somewhere else. Now, this inventory, resentment inventory. Well, Ralph, what about resentments? What if I can't see my partner resentment? You name one that's your dad, and yeah, you can see that in the rest. But what about real resentments? You know, we've been listening to, you know, you hear the news and the rest of this, Sandusky and all that stuff. And sometimes you might think, well, what about them boys that Sandusky was doing? What if they were in the program? Imagine they'd have a resentment in him. I'm the boy. The coach is the person, the cause. He molested me. What did it affect? My self-esteem, yeah. My pride, yeah. Probably affected all seven areas of self. Well, Ralph, what's my part? What if that happened to me? What if I'm the boy? What if I'm the girl? What if I'm my part in the resentment? A couple of things about doing resentment inventory, really important. Really, 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 really important. Being free of the resentment does not mean I excuse, condone, or exonerate the behavior that brought the resentment on. Every now and then, real things happen to real people. Real bad things are visited upon people by real bad people every now and then. In my life, most of my resentments have been up in here. But there are times when things happen in this to people, especially folk like us. Being free of the resentment does not mean I excuse, condone, or exonerate the behavior that brought it on. Somebody in here is operating with the idea that if I let go of the resentment, I'm excusing what it is that happened. If I let go of the resentment, I'm condoning what Uncle Charlie did to me. If I let go of the resentment, I'm saying what Uncle Charlie did is all right. If I let go of the resentment, I'm opening myself up for that to be for it to happen again. If I let go, isn't this resentment all that I have to hold on to? You know, and yeah, you know, when I have that kind of resentment, and only you know, if it's working for you, keep it working for you. But if it's a barrier, if it's a third person in my bed all the time, if I'm having problems getting close to another person, if I can no longer go to family events, if I can no longer get close to another person, if there are walls that I hit in my life all the time that I just can't seem to surmount, if this resentment that I'm carrying is doing more to me, then I just might want to get rid of it. This ego-reducing exercise, that's the fourth step. While my ego is still alive, I let it work for me because it's still alive while I'm trying to reduce it. And I let it work for me in this way. I say, okay, Uncle Charlie, you might have came in my bed when I was 8 years old. I'm 48 years old. It's time for you to get out. You ain't going to own me anymore. It takes work and it takes process. It's not an event. But I need to know that's where I'm going. You ain't going to own me anymore. The book says this was our course. We realized that those who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. They, like ourselves. I ain't sick like his ass. No, I'm sick like my ass. I might not go up in the air. No. No, I'm sick like me. Just because I might not go up in the bed with a little boy don't mean on my whatever it is I do, I won't do. They like us. And that's the thing. Sometimes people think I got to match my sickness with his. No, 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 no. I guarantee you, you sitting on somebody's inventory. Oh, OK. I'm the only one. Don't be tittering. You know you own somebody's inventory. Got all that nervous laughter. Oh, yeah. You no, you are. Why are you playing up in your nervous laugh? Yes. Sitting up in here and then. And so, and I have to say, dude, you on somebody's inventory. You on somebody's inventory. You know, they, like ourselves, were perhaps spiritually sick. And some of the behavior that is the hardest behavior to get over, it's clear that they spiritually sick. Matter of fact, you said it. You said it to yourself, and that's how you've labeled it. Sick bastard, sick. Yes, he is. But right now, the reason I'm embarking on this path, and at this point, it don't talk about faith. It say we ask God to show us the same pity, tolerance, and patience we would a sick friend. Pity, tolerance, and patience. I know you getting ready to ask me to forget. Don't get ahead of yourself. You ain't capable of that yet. Right now, we just looking. Right now, I'm trying to get free. Right now, I'm trying to walk with my back up. I didn't realize I've been carrying this so long. I thought I had a hunchback. No, you don't. You've been carrying that stuff. Let it go. Let it go. what this program has to offer, go for all that this program has to offer. You can settle for the relief if you want to. This program offers relief, abstinence from drinking, or you can go for the freedom. A lot of people settle for relief. It's freedom. There's freedom. There's freedom. And the freedom is from the bondage of me, not Uncle Charlie. Uncle Charlie is in New York or in Connecticut. Uncle Charlie somewhere else. But he in here. Freedom from the bondage of me. I'm carrying Uncle Charlie. Wow. And I want to be free. I want to, but it's, damn, I'm hardwired. It seems, yeah. Yeah. That's why I'm glad to have a fellowship. That's why I'm glad to have a roadmap. That's why I'm glad to have a design for living. That's why I'm glad I get on my knees and I say, somebody else got to take this because I'm hardwired. Self can't overcome self. I need a power to do it. And it's a process. Well, Ralph, I've done a fourth step and I've done a fifth step. I've done that. I've shared about Uncle Charlie. I've written about Uncle Charlie. And he still seems like I just can't get over it. That's because this ain't a five-step program. It's a 12-step program. The relief, it ain't going to come just because I do the writing and I do the sharing. But it's the place that I begin. And that's why this is an integrated series of actions that if I take them in their entirety, it's going to produce something in me. Carl talked about it's going to wake up a spirit in me that's been dormant and sleeping. It's going to wake something up in me and I'm going to be able to walk and I'm going to enjoy something I didn't even know was out there for me. Do you want it? Is the question I have to ask myself. Do you want it? And so I embark on this deal and I start looking and don't be scared. Yes, it's going to hurt, but not looking hurts. Damn, I don't want to reopen that one. Yeah, but it ain't going nowhere. It's tainting and contaminating everything else. Resentments are like, they like some rotten tomatoes and they like mushrooms. The thing about a resentment, you could have everything else cool. You know, yeah, I'm cool. I've written on everybody else, moms, pops, boo, 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 but I'm not going to look at them. And you have that one resentment sitting in there. You got one rotten tomato sitting in the thing with 12 other tomatoes. What happens? You don't get that one rotten one out, what happens? All other ones get rotten. Contaminates my thinking. Same thing. And then they like mushroom soup. Resentments, they get to growing. Not only do they contaminate the good stuff, they start multiplying and growing. And next thing you know, you walking around thought your house was clean. And next thing you know, because I wasn't thorough. And that one, Uncle Charlie, that unseen elephant, that's one. So I inventory it. I look at it. They, like ourselves, were perhaps spiritually sick. We ask God to grant us the patience. And then I ask myself, where have I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, or afraid? What's my part in the resentment? Well, the first part is I had a resentment. You know, okay, was it selfish that an 8-year-old kid didn't want somebody coming up in his room and violating him? No, that's not selfish. That's not selfish. Was it dishonest? My wife used to share, and I steal from it sometimes. Because she used to share about this. She was an incest survivor and she was a rape survivor. And she would share about her stepdaddy coming in her room. And she said in her, when she would do her fourth step, and she would say, is it selfish or dishonest? And she would go with dishonest. Because she said it started out as molestation and it ended up as prostitution. Don't fit everybody. I just throw it out there for your inspection. It might land in somebody's lap. Because it started out involuntary, but it ended up with her seeking him out because it was something in it for her. Something in it for her. It's a tangled web when you go there. Because there are things that happen bodily that maybe my body responds in spite of my head. That don't happen with everybody. I've done enough fifths and I've listened to enough. So there's this thing going on that I'm all messed up now. Because I'm liking what I ain't supposed to be liking. So then, you know, and my wife used to, but in hers, not everybody's, in hers she put dishonesty. Started as molestation, ended as prostitution. Just, and if you ain't ready, if you ain't ready to put on your big boy and big girl pants and panties, don't do inventory. Because when I do inventory, I don't, you know, as you can tell, I don't sugarcoat. It's mine. Why would I sugarcoat it? I talk in my language and I talk about it, and I'm hard on myself, and I'm always considerate of other people. But I'm always hard on myself. Hard on myself. So she said that. Self-seeking or afraid. If you can't find it in selfish, and if you can't find it in dishonest or self-seeking, always find it in fear. Uncle Charlie is the person. He molested me. What's my part? I was scared I brought it on. I was scared everybody can see that there's something wrong with me. I was scared I'm damaged good. I'm scared I'm never going to be enough. I'm scared I'm never going to be worth a relationship. I'm scared I'm never going to be with anybody worthwhile. I'm sure everybody knows that about me. I'm scared that you can see that there's something wrong with me. I'm scared. I'm scared. I'm scared. I'm scared. I'm scared. And when I get scared, I get mad. Anger is not often a standalone emotion. Usually it's a mask for some others. When I get scared, I get mad. And so I nurse the anger. And I think it protects me. And I end up building fences to keep you out. And I look up some years later and I realize I've erected a structure to keep me in. And I'm trapped in it. And we have a way out. We have a way out. I always get stuck in resentment inventory, and then they start flashing me my last couple of minutes, and I'm like, oh my God, there are two other inventories in inventory. Fear inventory, we've talked a lot about fear. You know, and again, we put the fears on paper too. We ask ourselves, why do we have the fears? Book has a strange sentence. Book says, isn't it because self-reliance failed us? As if I'm just supposed to draw that conclusion. I didn't know that. That's how I read the book. I turn statements into questions. And when they say, when they just make a statement like it is, well, then I ask myself, is that true for me? Check this out. Don't be a bobblehead about the book. Don't just be nodding, yeah, it's in the book, so it's true. How you know? Read it. If the book can't withstand scrutiny, it's not worth the ink and the paper it's printed on anyway. It's not true because it's in the book. It's in the book because it's true. This book is a compilation of experiences of some folk. And it ain't, all of it ain't true for me, but I bet you the stuff that ain't true for me is true for somebody else. I never stood at the, when Bill tell his story, that's his story. But there's so much of his story that's my story. Talked about the drive for success was on Proving the World. But I never stood at a window with my sass getting ready to jump. But don't make, so Bill, and so right there, he says, we ask ourselves, why do we have these true fears? Isn't it because self-reliance failed us? I get scared because me relying on me can't bring about the desired result. I can't make you like me. I can't make you accept me. I can't make you give me the job. I'm scared to go on the interview because I know you're going to reject me because me in and of myself can't produce the desired result. You know, I'm scared of even, I'm scared of not having enough money. I'm scared, you know, and that whole fear thing, distill it. Let's go backwards to Maryland's step. God is either everything or he's nothing. He either is or he isn't. And then we go forward to this. Isn't it because self-reliance failed us? So either God is everything, because what's less than God? Me. He's either, and when he's not everything, I get scared. I get scared of what my money situation looked like. I get scared because I ain't been in, you know, I might not have been in a job for the last 2 years. What's going to happen to me? I get scared because the kids, I get scared because he or she ain't doing what I want. I get scared because I can't see no way out. And that's because now you are everything. God is either everything or he is nothing. So when it talks about our fear slip away, it doesn't mean that I know where my money's coming from. It means I got a long track record with his power and he got me anyway. I don't know what it's going to look like. I don't know how it looked like when he got me. I just know he got me. Long track record of answered prayer. Long track record of answered prayer. Sometimes I have to say to myself, Ralph, what make you think he saved you from that cesspool to let you drown in the bathtub? In the bathtub. been on that path for a while. I've been in some fear. Money not looking right. Job situation not looking right. You know, emotional situation. Stuff's not looking right. God's either everything or he's nothing. Long history of answered prayer. You know, and the thing about prayer, you know, prayer may not change things for you, but it'll change you for things. It'll change you for things. And I remember that because I'm looking at some things, but I'm not the same guy that's in the things that used to be. So we do that fear inventory. Then there's the last inventory, sex inventory. Really should be called a sex conduct inventory. If you've never done a sex inventory, it is not the sober Kama Sutra. Don't go there. It is not about inventory and positions and places and be none of that. No. It should be more accurately referred to as the sex conduct inventory. And unlike other inventories, and unlike Cosmo and Mademoiselle and all that, where it says these are the things you should look for in a mate, what the sex inventory process does for me is these are the things, Ralph, you need to incorporate in you to be a mate. The things that all we talk about is shining the light on ourselves. These are the things in me. And they'll change what it is that I'm worth. And it'll change what it is I'm qualified to look forward to. Fifth step, real fast, you know, Bob, you know, we're already at the end and I'm just glossing through the fifth step. First, you know, and the fifth step, many people in here have heard fifth steps. It is one of the great privileges in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the great privileges in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you haven't tasted sponsorship, three legacies, unity, recovery, and service. Unity, I take my body to the fellowship. And I fell in love with the fellowship before I fell in love with the program. And I start going to meetings, and I meet you guys. And I start walking with my head up a little bit. Recovery. 12 steps. Treat my mind with the 12 steps. Got into that, started doing that. And then I take that third part, spirit. Unity, recovery, and service. I take my recovery spirit and I put it in the service. Highest calling in Alcoholics Anonymous. Highest calling. See the lights come on for somebody. That's a huge deal. Especially when you come from the place I come from. Useless, worthless, unnecessary, unwanted, and unneeded. Came in here and you guys put my feet in motion. And I started doing the deal. Started working with some people. Started listening. People ask all the time, when am I ready to sponsor people? How am I qualified to sponsor people? You know, shit. When are you ready to have a baby? When you're pregnant? You get qualified when you have it. You know, God don't call a qualified, he qualifies the call. When you start working with people, that's when you learn how to. You ain't going to learn how to from a book. You ain't going to learn how to from your sponsor telling you how to work with others. You're going to learn how to from working with others. And you're going to learn sponsorship from sponsoring. And you're going to learn fifth steps from listening. And listening to a fifth step, every time I listen to a fifth step, I take a fifth step. I share with the people I listen to. It's a tremendous privilege to me for anybody to think enough of me to share themselves with me from the places I come from. Highest calling in Alcoholics Anonymous. So when I listen to a fifth, just some real quick things most of you already know. You know, it's some easy do's and don'ts in fifth steps. You know, whatever you do, don't be, oh, shit, no, that's not what you're doing up there. Don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do the, oh, no, you didn't. Those are not things we do in fifth step. You know. You know, but it says, most of us now, because of the way we're situated, we don't have to just look for anybody. We don't have to look for a clergy person, though you can if you want to, or just a closed mouth friend. Most of us take a fifth step with our sponsor.
Right on. Thank you, Ralph.